Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
We come to this week's podcast bearing dispatches from the frontiers of science. But for anyone worried that might be a bit, well, out there, we'll be coming right back down to earth to interview a poet who has a sideline in chronicling his own lifelong battles with alcoholism and depression. Here, though, is a sample of the sort of fighting talk you can expect from our man at the SETI Institute in California. For the last 50 years, it's been searching for signs of extraterrestrial life.
All the world's great religions were formulated in a pre-scientific era, and they all place human beings in a very important role, even a central role. The fact that there is this bigger community, no existing religion could survive. They all say that it's not a problem, but I'm absolutely convinced it'll all be swept away. Now, Christianity is especially vulnerable to the discovery of advanced alien intelligences because of the unique nature of the incarnation. Jesus didn't come and die to save the dolphins or the chimpanzees or the gorillas or the Neanderthals, but to save one particular species with one particular genome. Now, if you've got advanced alien beings who presumably have been around for a lot longer than we have, then they'll have solved a great deal of their social unrest and a great deal of their criminality, and probably would have engineered their genomes to remove grossly criminal behaviour. They will be saintly beings. And so then we face the problem, if you're a Christian, are they not to be saved?
Astrophysicist Paul Davis on this week's Guardian Science Weekly podcast. His new book, The Eerie Silence: Are We Alone in the Universe, is one of two very different accounts of cutting-edge science out this month. The other is The Language of Life, DNA and the Revolution in Personalised Medicine. That's by Francis Collins, who Barack Obama has just appointed Director of the National Institutes of Health, a much richer version of the UK's Medical Research Council. With me to discuss them are science writer Tim Radford and the editor of our own Guardian Books website, Sarah Crown, who's a science fiction buff with a side interest in scientific anecdote. Let's begin with Paul Davis, who you've reviewed for this week's Saturday Review, Tim. Who is he and why should we take notice of him?
Well, he's, as people will have worked out for themselves, he's an Englishman who left England in the Thatcher years, went out to Australia and then ended up in Arizona at the Beyond Centre, where he's looking at what you might call very far-fetched astrophysics.
I called it SETI. What is it?
Oh, no, the SETI program is a kind of cooperative involving several projects.
What does SETI stand for?
SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Now, he has a very particular role, doesn't he, in the SETI Institute, which is to welcome aliens should they arrive.
We should be so lucky. His particular role is to actually discuss what to do and how to work out whether it's a true signal if they ever get a message from an alien. What do we do then? And how do we know it's a genuine signal and not some sort of prankster from down the road? So there's quite a lot of thinking to be done before you make an announcement, because it will be an epoch-making event. It really will be.
It will be, you're saying.
Oh, I think it will happen.
50 years and we haven't had a bleep.
What's 50 years in a 13.7 billion year existence? The timescales are horrendous. To have a carbon-based life form, you've got to have carbon. You can't have carbon until you've had a whole generation of stars that have formed, died, exploded, shattered their debris all over the universe, and then formed a second generation of stars, or possibly a third. So if you were looking out into space, you wouldn't think of looking for many billions of years, because life hasn't had time to form at all. And then you'd say to yourself, and how long does it take intelligent life to form? If you look at the size of the universe, how many stars are there in this galaxy? About 400 billion. How many galaxies are there? About 400 billion galaxies, each with 400 billion stars. It was a wonderful experiment by the Hubble Space Telescope, in which somebody effectively held a grain of sand at a distance of 75 feet and just examined that one little speck of sky, dark sky. Every time Hubble went round, it collected some light. It collected it all together on a plate, and then doubled the size of the universe, because what it could see in this little patch of blackness, of nothingness, was another 200 billion galaxies.
Sarah, is this the sort of thing that worries you at night when you stare off into that starry sky?
I think it's too big to worry about. It's too big to comprehend. It's absolutely mind-boggling stuff, and I was really fascinated. I've had a sneak preview of Tim's review, and it's completely fascinating stuff, even to a non-scientist like me.
Let's just move on now to the second person we're going to be talking about, Francis Collins. Explain him. We're going to a very, very different scale of enterprise.
Yes, we're going to actually someone with much the same charm, poise, and command of language as Paul Davis. So Francis Collins is American. He is, I've always understood, an ex-rocker. He is also an extraordinarily nice man.
His book is about DNA and the revolution in personalised medicine. What is personalised medicine?
Personalised medicine is the whole point of genomic or DNA research. Why does a drug work on you and your children, but not your cousin? And the answer is your cousin has a slightly different genetic makeup and cannot metabolise the same dose that you can metabolise. So all treatment so far has been trial and error. What people have done is sort of broadcast 1,000 patients with the same dose and then said, well, it seems to work more than 30% of the time, so it's obviously doing some good.
He makes a rather startling prediction, which is that within 5 to 7 years, we will be carrying our own personalised genome around in our back pockets, along with our mobile phone and our wallets. Sarah, how does that seem to you?
Science fiction, I suppose. It seems completely beyond the concept of reality, as far as I'm concerned. But then I suppose we were saying that 15 years ago about the way we are all now with iPhones and wandering around with access to a worldwide web.
So is it actually a possibility,
Oh,
Tim?
Yes, it's a possibility, right. The commercial race is on for a technology that will sequence a genome accurately. That's the point. It's got to be accurate. I cannot remember the size of the book you would have to print a 3 billion alphabet, which is what you're talking about. And then, of course, you have to be able to read it accurately. So we're talking about some pretty heavy-duty research.
Now, this brings me to the next point, which is these are very sort of high-technology books, as you said, and they're quite dense, and the science is quite complicated for ordinary mortals. Are they readable? Are they the sort of thing that I might want to get out of the library?
Davis's book is immensely readable in the sense that he very carefully walks around all the technological terminology that an astrophysicist might be tempted to use and addresses the subject almost completely in the language of an educated layman. Mm-hmm. Collins, of course, is stuck with a whole new language which has been invented for biology.
But he does, Sarah, have some lovely anecdotes, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He's very good at the anecdotes. And I think that these are absolutely essential to the non-science reader like me. He talks about there's a really brilliant one about the BRCA1 gene, which is the gene that is responsible for sort of genetically inherited cases of breast cancer. And funnily enough, I actually knew about this gene from another book, which was Dina Rabinovich's memoir of Cancer, Take Off Your Party Dress. And she was Jewish, and the Hebrew word BRCA, which is what the shortening BRCA is pronounced as, means blessing in Hebrew. And that's a really good example of why anecdotes, I think, are so important in science books, because I'm never, ever going to forget the BRCA1 gene now because of that. And Collins is very good at doing exactly the same sort of thing. So he's talking about the BRCA1 gene, about a research programme, the Family of 15 research programme, a woman who was spared a double mastectomy because she participated in this kind of extremely cutting-edge science. He also goes on to talk about Woody Guthrie and Huntington's disease. And Huntington's is this absolutely horrible illness, which if you've inherited it, you absolutely will contract it at some point, probably in your 40s. And it's degenerative and you will die from it.
And Woody Guthrie had it
and he died from it. Yes, which was something that I didn't know at all before. But again, it's something that I'm never going to forget. And I think that's what makes a good science writer, is somebody who can give you something to hang on to with the science.
Now, Tim, going back to the science, there are a couple of big buts in this, aren't they? That these are relatively, to a person like Collins, simple diseases to get the hang of. I mean, the big killers like heart disease or cancer are multifactorial, aren't they?
They're multifactorial. There's supposed to be 4,000 single gene diseases. Cystic fibrosis is one of the best known. And Collins, of course, is famous for identifying the cystic fibrosis gene and then the Huntington's gene and then two or three others. His record as a scientist is very considerable.
He likened the hunt to cystic fibrosis. I love this. He likened it to looking for a single little burnt-out light bulb in the basement of a house somewhere in the United States. But then he went on to talk about, he said, of cancer and heart disease, there are a dozen or more light bulbs to discover, and they weren't even expected to be burnt out, just subtly dimmer than they should be.
Yes, that does roughly sum up the challenge of heart disease and a lot of these other conditions. Clearly, we're going to benefit from this research. We have already started to benefit from this research. We remember these amazing promises that were made nearly 10 years ago when the human genome was sequenced. And of course, what people found almost immediately was that it was much more complicated than it looked. They did in fact have a manual for a human being, but they didn't actually know how to assemble it or make it run smoothly. And the next 10 years will be focused on trying to understand the processes that go on in this strange keyboard in which we know what the keys are, but we don't quite know how they should be played together.
The other big but, of course, which arises for this is about the moral issues involved with designer babies. Are we going to have designer babies?
People get ever so cross if you put it the other way around and said, are we going to have babies without cystic fibrosis? The answer would be yes, please. We'd much rather have babies without cystic fibrosis or any of those other hideous afflictions that you can see. If that's a designer baby, then I think we're probably all in favour of it. Do we want our babies to be good athletes and blue-eyed? No, not necessarily. We want them to be whatever they are, but we would really rather they weren't born to suffer.
He does also point out that in order to select for, say, musicality, you'd have to have millions of eggs from the same person to be able to select the 10 that had the quality you wanted.
I think the idea of a perfect baby is not something we should be chasing. We should be just grateful for healthy babies who are not condemned to die in the first five years of life. That would be great.
To come back just to, very quickly to his niceness, Sarah, he ends with this lovely anecdote about a baby called Hope, born in 2000, and surmises two possible scenarios. And I think this just shows how politically engaged he is, as well as scientifically.
Yes, well, just using the name Hope, obviously, gets us off to a good start. But he has the one scenario in which Hope and her husband both live to be 100 due to preventative genomic. I'll take advisement on that one, medicine. And in the other scenario, the alternative scenario, she dies at 50 because of the inadequacies of private healthcare and her diet and her exercise, and she dies just as her husband's cancer is spreading to his liver. So obviously a far less hopeful scenario.
Doesn't that just say everything? Now, I'm going to widen this out a little bit because I picked the particular extract we opened with of Paul Davis talking about God because I imagine Francis Collins would strongly contest it. He is a committed Christian.
He was a medical missionary and actually caught first malaria and then tuberculosis. Not diseases that most Western rich medically aware people catch these days, because he exposed himself to great danger in looking after other people. He's never made a secret of his Christianity, but I'm old enough to wonder why everyone else is surprised by this, because I can remember when it was normal to describe yourself as C of E and even to go to church on Sunday, whether you really believed in God or not. You just subscribed to the notion of Christianity, and you would never surprise to find that there were people who took it seriously. Now, oddly enough, in the post-Dawkins era, we are. It doesn't seem to make Collins any less of a scientist. So that bit doesn't worry me.
Now, there was one particularly interesting blog response to the Science Weekly podcast, which David spoke on, from somebody called Terra Tornis.
I'd suspect science fiction has had something to do with the rise in respectability of SETI. Nearly all of today's scientists and the billionaires who fund SETI grew up watching science fiction films and reading science fiction books. Nearly all science fiction takes the existence of extraterrestrial aliens as a matter of course. It's hard to write interest in science fiction otherwise. To harbour doubt about their existence makes one almost a contrarian now. It's hard to dispel with mere words the expectation built up through exposure to thousands of hours of expertly crafted books and films. We can rain on the parade with the Fermi paradox plus Occam's razor, i.e. the simplest explanation for why they aren't already here is that they don't exist in our light cone, but one watching of Avatar blows the killjoys away.
Blows the killjoys away. Tim, do you think Terra Tornis has a point?
Well, he has a point, but it is he seems to imply that an interest in extraterrestrial intelligence is only as old as science fiction, which, of course, is not true. Thomas Jefferson, Isaac Newton, and Voltaire himself all supposed that if there were habitable planets, they must be inhabited. And Voltaire, of course, has his own little science fiction, splendid entertainment called Zadig, I think, in which a Saturnian comes to Earth and treads on a ship and generally splashes around in the North Sea as if he was paddling up to his ankles. The 18th century in particular was fascinated by the idea of what it meant for religion if extraterrestrials existed. Did the death on the cross redeem them too, or did they actually have to undergo their own salvation in some other form?
So we're back to science and religion again.
We're back to science and religion.
Nevertheless, I would say both of these are science fiction tropes, aren't they? That the idea of the alteration of the genome and also aliens coming and invading us.
Yes, we talked in our podcast earlier in the year on science fiction about The Day of the Triffids, and that's a book that predicts a lot of what we now take for granted in daily life about genetic modification and the idea of producing a plant that meets your needs, all of that sort of thing. But there's lots of ways in which science fiction has frequently kind of preempted science. So, for example, Arthur C. Clarke came up with the idea of satellites sort of fairly famously, and he's also fairly widely credited with discovering the geosynchronous orbit, so a satellite that stays above a particular spot on the Earth. And Jules Verne as well, submarines, he was supposed to be the first person to come up with that. Cell phones, we get those from Star Trek probably, you know, with the little wrist communicators and that kind of thing.
Tim is nodding enthusiastically here. I can see you're obviously a science fiction buff as well.
I really love the early Victorian Wells and indeed Verne. The problem with science fiction now is that actually the things that science has done has left very little room for science fiction. The achievements of cosmic physics in the last 40 years, genetics research, for instance, have actually astounded everybody. And it's difficult to know what a science fiction writer can do. That won't stop them.
If all this has left you feeling a little dizzy, let's turn to a writer whose work is firmly centred in his own experience, John Burnside. His second volume of memoir, Waking Up in Toy Town, was published earlier this year. Here he grapples with the problems that plagued his early adulthood, from alcoholism to the neurological condition of apathemia. That's the experience of perceiving patterns and connections in random objects. The book picks up where his first memoir, A Lie About My Father, left off. It charts his attempts to shake off his demons and live a, quote, normal, unquote, life. He spoke on the telephone to Sarah Crown. She asked him why he decided to write about this difficult period.
I probably wouldn't have written if I hadn't written the previous memoir before it. At the end of that, at the end of the process of writing that, I started thinking about, where it went on from there. I kind of rounded that one off with a scene that kind of brought me up to the present day, but I felt as though that it was worth talking about the time when I was trying to be normal, as it were. And that kind of frame of mind and that kind of difficulty that I was experiencing at that time is something that should be talked about anyway. I don't want to turn some kind of crusading author or something, but I felt it was worth just putting those kind of questions out there for people to read and maybe think about.
This idea of apophenia is that it you have a too great tendency to see the meaning in things, the connections between things.
Yeah.
Is that right? And this I thought was very interesting because as somebody who's read a lot of your poetry, mm-hmm. It sounds to me almost like a description of the way in which you write. Something that you return to again and again in your poetry is this sense of connectedness. Is poetry then a sort of a sanctioned outlet for this, do you think?
Well, I think it's what's interesting for me anyway is that something that could, in one manifestation, looked at through a psychiatrist's magnifying glass, as it were, seem to be some kind of pathology, could also be what produces art or produces kind of visions of things and imaginary world, etc. They seem to be the two sides of the same coin, and it can be ignored. It won't go away, the fact that so many people in the history of the creative kind of field, painters, writers, musicians even, have suffered from what most people would consider mental problems, mental illnesses or depression or whatever it might be. And I think it's something that we sometimes turn away from, perhaps especially in our own culture. We tend to try and have much more normal art than perhaps several other cultures I could think of.
It's something that you come to in the book, obviously, that you say at the beginning that you want to move to find a Surbiton of the mind, is the phrase that you say, and this kind of exaggerated normality to sort of anchor yourself with, I suppose. And so you're coming up with this idea of normality which you're trying to escape into.
Yeah, and it was an idea of normality that was created by somebody who was in a very desperate situation. I mean, I was really at the bottom of the pile, really, at that stage. And I thought that the only way out for me from how I was living was to find myself as normal a life as possible. And, of course, I made a lot of mistakes about what I thought a normal life might be. I mean, I thought normal life was boring life, you know, to go and live somewhere where really in a very banal situation, doing a very ordinary job, living in an ordinary place, living someplace where nothing ever happened. Of course, when you actually move into the suburbs, you realize it's full of people who are, some of them are quite like you, actually, and not all of them are normal, that's for sure. My idea of normality was a fraud from the beginning, and it took me a long time to figure out that, you know, that I was the one with the problem. I just thought that the normal world had disappointed me and let me down in some way.
You talk then about being at your sort of lowest ebb at this point in your life, and you go into that in some detail in the book, talking about heavy drinking, these bouts of insanity, and just the sort of basic bleakness of your life at that point. This, I thought, was interesting because it comes back into the idea of truthfulness, I suppose, in memoirs. It's a question that people often ask, you know, how possible is it to be truthful? And if you throw madness into the mix and heavy drinking, does that complicate it even further? Is it possible, do you think, to write truthfully about experiences like that?
Depends what you mean by truthful, I suppose. that is probably the most interesting issue for me, is that we live in a society where factual means truthful. A moment's thought makes us realize that, in fact, truth is much more interesting and much more complex than the given fact. I didn't invent any facts for the book. I didn't, you know, make anything up. I had to change a few things, obviously, because there were people who had to be protected in terms of identity. But I believe that the book is more truthful than say, a doctor's report on my condition at the time, because that's someone looking from the outside. I mean, I had to pay money, but I actually got transcript of reports, medical reports on me during that time. So I'm talking about from the inside and trying to give an accurate picture of what that's like from the inside as I can. I think it's impossible to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, etc. But I think it's the only way to actually get truth, as opposed to simply recounting the facts, is through art, actually, some kind of imaginative endeavor, because you have to fill in the gaps that the simple factual narrative leaves.
And that's, I suppose, when you're reading the book, that's the point at which things seem to calm down and smooth out, is the point at which you start writing, start writing poetry. And that was interesting reading it, because it does seem to be a correlation between your producing art and feeling more at peace with yourself, I suppose.
I mentioned the writing because it did actually have a function in my day-to-day life. And I did have that. It was the first thing I'd ever done that I took seriously. I had never cared about anything before that I did. And, you know, that's why I had drifted, basically, throughout my life. It could have been anything. It could have been flower arranging. It could have been carpentry. It has a role in the book, in the story, therefore it's in the book. But I didn't want to make it into this, a writer's memoir.
The title, Waking Up in Toy Town, can you explain what that's about?
Toy Town, in a sense, was what I thought the suburbs was to begin with, and, you know, a little model village almost, a nice place where everything was clean and orderly, and you could almost move things around to make them right. And that was my, you know, naive impression of what the suburbs might be before I arrived there. Later on, I began to realize that my view of the suburbs was a kind of Toy Town view. That was it was a childish view. It was an immature view of what was really there. And so I hope that it could be read in both ways. The question of waking up, I mean, the last line of the book is the only point, in a sense, where the character in the book, who I think of as a character now, is myself in the past, but it's not me now. That last line is when he wakes up. I mean, he has a realization that he's been living this lie, if you like, this fraud all this time, that he wasn't a real soul living among phantoms, but in fact he was the phantom. And then at that point, he wakes up. He begins to live as himself. And that's the waking up point. And he says, this is the beginning of the new life.
Would you ever move back to the suburbs?
No.
The very unsuburban John Burnside talking to Sarah Crown. Waking Up in Toytown is published by Jonathan Cape. And that's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Tim Radford, John Burnside and, of course, Sarah Crown. You can get more science in the Observer's new review on Sunday. It looks at some little-known Einstein papers now on display in Jerusalem. In this week's Guardian Saturday review, we'll be reviewing Francis Collins' book, among others, and the historian Tony Judd will prescribe a cure for the sickness of the left in today's materialistic society. To hear the full interview with Paul Davis, which we mentioned early on in the podcast, go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. I'm Claire Armistead, and the producer is Scott Corley. Until next week, goodbye.